This is an FCIC interview of Tom Fontana of Citigroup. It is Friday, August 13th at 9 a.m. We are at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission headquarters.
Okay. It is Friday, August 13th, 2010. We're at the offices of the FCIC in Washington, D.C., interviewing Mr. Tom Fontana. Correct? Okay. Mr. Fontana, thank you for coming in. My name is Chris Seifer. The other folks at the table are also with the FCIC. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009. It tells us to figure out the causes of the financial crisis by the end of this year and prepare a report and deliver it to the President and Congress by December 15th. That statute tells us to look at various things, including the issue of too big to fail. We are currently looking at that issue, and we are both looking at Lehman Brothers and Wachovia right now. And in terms of Lehman Brothers, one of the things we're doing is looking how counterparties were managing their exposures with Citibank to hopefully give us some insight on whether or not perhaps counterparties thought Lehman was too big to fail or thought Lehman wouldn't fail or whatever they thought. And that's why we wanted to talk to you, because we have seen in the documents in the Veloukis report that Citi was one of Lehman's clearing banks, and at least towards the end, I believe, was asking for some additional collateral. So before we get into the substance, why don't we, just so we have a clear record on the tape, have folks identify themselves, and then I'll let Joby take over.
Should I start?
Yep.
Okay. I'm Tom Fontana. I am today the Chief Risk Officer for the Global Transaction Services businesses at Citigroup. I've been with Citigroup for 22 and a half years. During the period that we'll be discussing, I was the Global Risk Manager for financial institutions, banks, brokers, insurance companies, insurance guarantors. I had pretty much everything that went through.
That's
debts.
Fine. Let's just get everybody's name on the record, then we'll get into the substance.
Okay. Claudia Hammerman from Paul Weiss, and with me is Dan Thacker and George Krupp, also from Paul Weiss.
Tom Stanton, FCIC staff.
Joby Ngannon, staff at FCIC.
Sarah Knaus, staff at FCIC.
Chris Seifer and Donna Norman will probably join us at some point. Go ahead, Joby.
So before we get to the substantive questions, let's go over your background, your education, your work history, and if you could, just lay out your positions and your role, and also lay out the dates. So let's start with college.
Okay, we're going that far back. I went to Hofstra University on Long Island. I graduated at Hofstra in 1980. Mm-hmm. I joined the Dime Savings Bank, working in securities lending. I worked at the Dime outside. I sat outside the treasurer's office, and we lent Dime securities. So it was our own portfolio that we were lending out, small operation, one person reporting to the treasurer. Did that for just over a year, and then I moved over to Irving Trust, doing something very similar, except lending out not only Irving securities, but the securities of their clients. So a much bigger operation. You sat around a trading desk, and you lent out securities, typically taking in cash as collateral and trying to get a bigger return for your custodian clients. I did that for probably a year and a half, mm-hmm. And then moved on to the Federal Home Loan Bank of New York, so District 2, initially working in their safekeeping area, so it's still related to securities, so the skills from Dime and Irving worked well going to the Federal Home Bank. I had that role. I was their assistant manager, then ultimate manager of the custody operation. I did that for probably 3 years, and then the savings and loans were a bit in a crisis. They were looking for examiners, and I made a jump to become a bank examiner. Mm-hmm. And so I was a bank examiner for savings and loans in New York, New Jersey, and Puerto Rico for 4 years.
And was this around 1986?
This was 1985, 86.
Okay.
So the crisis for the savings and loans was getting pretty deep, and the president said we need to get more examiners, and I sort of rode that wave and became examiner, went to examiner training school, and you know, they put me on loan into Odessa, Texas for a period of 3 months as we helped the Texas or the Dallas Federal Home Bank work through some of the problems that they had in their region.
And that's still with the Federal Home Loan Bank in New York?
Yeah, it was still the Federal Home Bank. I left the Federal. At the time, the Federal Home Bank had two roles. They had sort of the operations businesses, the custodian, the advances, and they also had the examination. We had them on two separate floors in the World Trade Center. So I worked on the 103rd floor when I was in the operations side, and then when I became a bank examiner, I moved down to the 102nd floor, and then was most often in the field. So being an examiner, looking through mortgage files, ultimately making my way up into an examiner in charge for small banks.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I guess, FIREA came out probably sometime in 89, at which point Citi was looking to strengthen its team on of analysts that would know the regulation. We had a lot of savings and loans in Citi, and they wanted to make sure they had somebody who really knew that regulation. So I joined Citi in April of 1989.
Mm-hmm.
And my job initially was an analyst covering banks, which was no surprise. Probably about a year into that, there was an effort to market the savings and loans. And since I knew them probably better than most people on the team, they said, leave the risk organization, come to the banking organization, and you could become a junior banker. So I became a junior banker, and I sort of carried the bags of the senior banker to California, and we called on Great Western, American Savings, and Home Savings, and all the big West Coast thrifts, which was probably 70 or 80% of the business that we were doing. And probably within 2 years, he said, you've proven yourself. I'm going to go back to the office and manage the business, and you can now become the banker for these savings and loans. I had the West Coast. I had the New Orleans banks. So I had a couple of pockets, but most of my time was spent on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
The effort struggled because the savings and loans probably didn't have the breadth of wallet that we Citi tends to look for in relationships. Basically, we would be buying mortgage from them. You didn't need to have a banker to do a single product. Once you introduce the product people, then the RM's value was less. So the savings and loan marketing effort was sort of brought down, and I then moved over to become a bank relationship manager.
What year was that?
It was probably 1993, I would think, okay. Maybe sometime in that year. And I took on the banks as well as finance companies. So I took CIT. I had Countrywide. So I was picking up a couple of the more of the diversified financial institutions. I did that for about 2 years. Decided that I didn't have important enough accounts. And I actually interviewed to leave Citi. And I was going to leave. The day that I resigned, the woman next to me resigned. She happened to cover some of the brokers, and I really didn't want to leave other than I wanted bigger accounts. So I went to see her manager and said, I really want to stay. And he said, well, tell me who you know. I told him who I knew. 10 minutes later, he said, we want you to stay, and you will handle Goldman, Bear, Lehman, Lazard, and a couple of small fund managers. Mm-hmm. So those four accounts were major relationships to Citi, and I felt this is where I want to be. I want to be working with accounts that make many millions of dollars for the company, where my service would be value. And so I was the relationship manager for those four brokers for probably about 5 years, maybe 5.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the summer of 2001, June of 2001, we had put together a task force to see how we can cover risk differently. At the time, relationship managers not only sold transactions, but they also wrote their own credit memos. And so you wore two hats. You brought in the deal, and then you turned yourself down, which was sort of a little bit of a conflict. So we determined that we needed to have an independent, more independent risk, and we were going to pull the risk away from RMs.
Mm-hmm.
And given my background, I said, we want you on the task force to determine what was going to happen, how much of the risk would move away, make sure the job was going to be done right from a risk view from relationship managers. And at the end of that task force, the guys who are now going to run that risk team said, we'd like you to join our team. Mm-hmm. We'd like you to manage the North American brokers. I said, I've always wanted to manage people. I think it's a skill that I have. So in June of 2001, I joined that team. At the time I joined, the guy who was going to run the bank team had resigned. I had great bank background, so I said, I'll do banks and brokers.
Mm-hmm.
So I went into the new role managing a team of 14 people, mm-hmm. covering North American banks and brokers. It was June 2001, 3 months later, 9/11. I was sort of the right guy in the seat because Bank of New York closed. We had requests from banks all around the globe and brokers needing money, right? Lots of people's money was locked up and they needed to get cash, and Citi was putting out lots of cash to try to keep things moving and not cause the crisis to be any worse than it already was.
Mm-hmm.
Gave me great insight, gave me great exposure. I sat next to the chief risk officer for Citi at the time, Dave Bushnell. And we didn't know each other all that well. I sat next to him for 4 or 5 weeks. He was in one cube, I was in another. We were in a war room. Okay.
It's just a brief introduction.
Okay. Well, he said start in college.
But
just tell us your
kind
position.
Okay.
All right. What's going on?
So I think we're.
I think they're trying to.
Okay. So we get beyond that.
The things they're most.
So this is around 2003.
2000.
Just fast forward.
Yeah. Probably 2000, late three, early four. There was an opportunity to take on the global insurance risk management role.
Okay.
And Citi's global. I was North America. I got a great opportunity to work for a global company, take a global role. So I was the global insurance risk manager for 3 or 4 years. We then decided to pull all risk for financial institutions into one division because the insurance risk was in the corporate division, which corporate risk area, which didn't make a lot of sense. We brought it all in, and then they made me co-head of global financial institutions risk management, and that was probably 2007, or maybe late 2007.
So that was your role up until
that was
the
my
crisis.
Role as we went through the crisis.
Can you describe Citi's clearing relationship with Lehman?
Okay.
Just describe the structure, who you reported to, who reported to you.
Okay. Who I reported to at the time of the crisis, I was reporting into Elena Matrullo. Elena was a managing director, a longtime Smith Bonney employee, and then when we all came together, we sort of bridged, brought Citibank people and Smith Bonney people together to form the new risk team.
So, I mean, there's a lot of words here, so just to make sure it's not lost, he's an independent risk. But he also has a background as a relationship manager and so knows these companies very well. And so at the time, he's an independent risk for banks, brokers, and insurance companies.
Correct.
Okay. And so you report up to...
I report into Elena Matrullo. And Elena...
Whose title was...
The managing director, and she was the global, we at the time called ourselves the Global Credit Center.
Okay.
Which handled the risk for financial institutions, hedge funds, SPVs, and municipalities. There was two core risk groups. That was one of the two core risk groups. Elena reported into Pat Ryan, and Pat Ryan had the both the risk groups. He had the corporate side as well as the financial institution side, and Pat went into Dave Bushnell.
Okay.
So that was the reporting chain.
And who reported to you?
To me, there was teams in New York, teams in London, and a team in Japan for the most part, and there was some people scattered around, but that's the key teams were New York, London, and Japan.
Can you describe your clearing relationship with Lehman Brothers?
Just want to be clear. His risk role is much broader than clearing. Clearing was one element of the relationship with Lehman, but I know it's an element that you're focused on. But I guess, given your background, you know an awful lot about clearing, so you can talk about different ways that. Citi cleared for.
I mean, if you want, you know, talk first about what your general job responsibilities were, second about what the Citi's relationship was Lehman, and then get to the clearing.
Sure. The general responsibilities were to do all the credit assessment analysis of the companies that were under my group. So we would look at financial statements, we'd look at annual reports, we would meet with clients, and at least on an annual basis, we would write up credit assessments. We would look at the risk of the company and sort of set the risk appetite that we were prepared to take with any one client, whether we should have to take derivatives on an unsecured basis or whether we should require security. So those types of decisions, whether if we're doing a loan, should it be unsecured, how many years, what should the key terms and conditions be of the loan. So that was the general role, and it was a big role, many clients. Now, the relationship with Lehman was very broad. Mm-hmm. We had lending, direct lending, sort of CP backstops with them. We had extensive derivatives and capital markets businesses, FX, futures. So it was a very big relationship, as you would expect. And clearing is one of those key relationships that we built over the years. We've probably cleared for Lehman in over 30 different countries, both securities and cash. So there's really two products in the clearing business. The securities, the way risk is created is that you move cash when the client doesn't have it in their account. So on the security side, the client says, purchase this security for me. The security comes in, you give the cash. You have the security, but you're waiting for the client to give you the cash later in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we deal with top clients, so that money tends to come in, and you put the money out, and it comes in, and that's sort of that clearing risk. On the pure cash side,
I've seen terms. I want to make sure I'm understanding. That risk that you're talking about, that clearing risk, is that where a city is providing intraday credit?
Intraday, correct. That's intraday. You know, any intraday can trip into overnight.
Right.
Right, so that's the concern. You know, intraday, the lines to Lehman were probably over $20 billion at one point.
Okay.
So we would have lines in, I think we cleared for them in New Zealand, certainly Japan. So you have lines that, while I'm sleeping, become active. Mm-hmm. And then as the day goes by, I get updates, Japan closed flat or positive. I know there's no risk there. And then EMEA opens up, and we go, you know, sort of around the globe.
Mm-hmm. And who are your contacts at Lehman Brothers?
Well, I'm a little unusual because I was their RM, so I knew a lot of the people there, so, which was good as we went through the crisis. So it was always CFO, treasurer, assistant treasurer, the head of cash management would be the key people.
So that would be Tanucci, Ian Lowitt?
Correct.
Dan Fleming?
Yes.
Okay. All right, since you talked about the crisis, let's get into it. June 12th, what precipitated Citi's demand for a comfort deposit?
Can we go back to Bear?
Okay.
I think very similar
Give
to what
Give us the context.
Right. That's fine.
Go back to Bear.
Okay. That's in March 2008.
Yeah. Can I ask one clarifying question? At what time frame was Lehman's intraday exposure to Citigroup?
Probably right through June, I think. It was pretty significant for a long time.
Through June,
Yes. It might have been a little bit further than that.
So
I think what's important about Bear is we learned a lot of lessons during Bear. Right? We had never seen a large financial institutions like that go sour so quickly. And a good thing about the GTS relationships is it gives us great insight. So as Bear is struggling, we're managing their cash at the end of the day, and we see that Bear is having difficulties bringing their account to flat or positive. So we see negative balances in their accounts. It's 530, it's 545, it's 550. The Fed's about to close, and they still haven't made us whole for the day.
Mm-hmm.
So as we went into the crisis with Bear, we took a cash deposit and actually had that deposit pledged probably 3 weeks, maybe a month, before Bear actually had their weekend and J.P. Morgan took them over.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of lessons that we had from Bear that we then recognized we need to be more proactive in how we, you know, roll that out as we go forward.
What was your exposure to Bear?
Very similar. Bear, we probably cleared in more countries. We probably cleared with the Bear in like 40 different countries. So the number of countries in which we did business with Bear was probably a little bit larger, and we probably had more in the lending side with Bear, and we were the lead on Bear's corporate headquarters financing, which was pretty significant. So it's similar. I would suspect that the clearing lines were probably within $1 billion of each other.
So $20 billion.
Correct.
And what was the amount of the deposit that you took from Bear?
The amount of deposit with Bear, if I recall, was about $1 billion.
$1 billion.
Yeah. $1.5 billion.
$1.5 billion.
And was that reduced to writing, or was that just an oral agreement between you and Bear's?
The Bear was it was reduced to writing.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Heading to.
Okay. So now I think the day after Bear failed, we decide we got to look at the broker dealers in total. Who's next in the list? And, you know, it was always perceived that the top five, Bear was the weakest and Lehman was next. So we classified Lehman early after Bear failed. So classified them, special mention in Citi language, it's a 1A. And we said that means we need to watch them more carefully as, you know, the weeks and months progress.
Who was third?
Third was probably Goldman. We would have said Goldman, Morgan, Merrill, Lehman, Bear. That was, I think, the general street thought. And if you look at their ratings, that's the way S&P and Moody's had rated the five companies.
Really? They had Morgan ahead of Goldman?
No, Goldman, Morgan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Merrill. Goldman always first.
All right. So describe to us June 12th, that week, and why, what precipitated the demand for deposit.
Or take us forward if you're not to June 12th.
No, I think we get to June 12th.
Quite frankly,
we watch a client closely. We kept having meetings with them.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt generally positive that this was not another Bear situation. If you met with a client, they would sit and a lot of the discussion was, why we're not Bear? And we don't have the prime brokerage business, which for Bear was huge. They had, I think it was something like $45 billion of prime brokerage deposits, monies that could run out of their company essentially overnight. Lehman didn't have that type of exposure. I think their number was less than $10 billion, so significantly different.
Four or five.
It was a smaller number, much smaller number. So as we went through it, we recognized Lehman had much lower risk than where we thought Bear was, and we thought we had a different situation. We were generally very positive, and fundamentally, if you did sort of the balance sheet assessment, they were pretty good standings as we got into the early summer.
And did you increase your contact with Lehman during this time between Bear and June 12th?
I would say probably a fair degree early in late March.
Mm-hmm.
And then we sort of got comfortable and we probably backed off April, May. And I think we were thinking things were stabilizing at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, then we started seeing, then more stress seemed to be coming into the market in general, and it was impacting Lehman probably more so than some other companies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you started seeing or observing, you know, the stock price, you know, having, you know, a lot more pressure on it.
Describe to us June 12th.
Before you describe June 12th, can you describe what, I'm sorry, Joby, what were the additional stresses you were seeing in the market leading up to June 12th?
Well, I think there was always concern regarding whether they've written their portfolio down to adequate levels. You know, something that, you know, from a Citi perspective, we didn't have insight into their, you know, how they were carrying their positions. Right? You would hear the market rumors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you turned on CNBC during, you know, June and July, all you heard was, you know, all the issues that these major financial institutions were facing, and Lehman, you know, was the one that they talked about most.
Mm-hmm.
And we know, of course, about David Einhorn's, you know, statements in both April and May of 2008. I mean, was that part of the, we have concerns about asset valuations at Lehman?
We always try to separate sort of rumors from reality. So you meet with the client, and the client around this time is saying, no one has written their portfolio down more conservatively than we had. And we had no reason not to believe that. Right.
Who told you that at Lehman?
The client. Exactly who said it, I don't know. I know that it was in our notes from meetings that we had with them around this period.
We can send you to the notes, but they essentially reflect that Lehman deleveraged a lot at this time,
mm-hmm.
meaning they sold a whole lot of stuff. And so what they were saying is, since we have current values, we have then marked down all analogous stuff to those current values.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, we can send you to a couple of places where they said, we would be surprised if we were not the most aggressively marked down on the street.
And again, your point of contact would be Tanucci and Lowett, the treasurer and CFO.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And we were meeting at, and I think during, it might have been, you know, around June 12th, we had the meeting with them where we went through, what's your liquidity? Well, they had increased.
June 5th.
They had increased. Glad you're here. They had increased their liquidity profile, where it was, you know, 25-30 to now with the liquidity was $45 billion.
Mm.
So we're saying, okay, great, because that's the biggest area of concern. If you want to look at how do you get through a difficult time, a run on a financial institution is probably our biggest concern. The fundamentals may show, you know, one thing, but you need to know how you prepare for that situation. And financial institutions, crisis, loss of confidence mm-hmm. is the biggest issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we started seeing as the summer progressed with Lehman.
And when you're meeting with them on June 5 and they're telling you and presumably showing you reports that say we have $45 billion in liquidity, were you guys also asking or trying to find out if any of that $45 billion was pledged or set aside as a comfort deposit, per se, for any other counterparties?
Well, I think the discussions we were having with the client, you know, initially when we asked for the deposit, we were concerned about risks that we were having in general. We had a lot of clearing exposures, and the number was big, and we said we need to make sure that risk is managed, and we were also worried about the derivatives portfolio where certain other clients were looking to step out of Lehman, and we were stepping in. And I'm certain that I must have wrote an email at one point that said, I don't want to be the last guy taking Lehman risk.
Mm-hmm.
So there were, you know, novations and assignments on the derivative side, which were coming in increasing volume. Mm-hmm. Which means someone else is getting out and I'm getting in, and you know, sort of not the kind of thing you want to do with, you know, if it's about to go bad. So we had multiple concerns about the risk that Lehman was facing. The fundamentals were improving. They delevered. I mean, they were, you know, levered highly like many others, and they brought themselves down, I think it was 25 times, where at one point it was probably 35, 40. So they brought their leverage down to a level where they felt, given our liquidity, given this leverage, we're comfortable with this.
Mm-hmm. So let me stop you. Thank you for that, but it didn't answer my question.
Okay.
When you talked to them on June 5th about liquidity, did you ask them about or try to find out whether or not any of that $45 billion was, you know, pledged or subject to comfort, whether it was real, right?
I don't think we did, and part of the reason was, you know, we had, the discussions had been for us to pledge this liquidity of scale would be an 8K event, you know, and so there was sensitivity with us.
Let's back up a bit. Okay. So we've got two different chronologies, and so just I just want to help.
I appreciate the
bit.
Help.
Your question is, at June 5, did you have any reason to believe that their unencumbered liquidity was somehow encumbered? That's the question. But I think where you're going is, when we asked for the comfort deposit on the 12th, so I think he's explaining why
if
he
we're
didn't
getting
doubt
that,
it.
That's
when we asked for the comfort deposit on the 12th, they said, we cannot pledge it and we cannot keep it longer than one day. So, or it would be an 8K event. So the assumption Citi had was that they hadn't done that with anyone else on the street, or there'd be an 8K.
Oh, we would have noticed
gotcha.
An 8K.
So,
so the answer is, we did not believe that anyone had pledged that this liquidity.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought it was real liquidity.
45 billion.
Yeah, and, you know, I guess the cash capital model that brokers had been following is sort of a standard industry. So we thought, from what we were hearing, everything seemed to be moving in the right direction.
What was your motivation to step in with innovations and increase your exposure to Lehman?
If you didn't step into innovation, what is the risk to Lehman?
The motivation is, not stepping in sends a signal to those who want to novate out. And the signal is, you don't want to take their Amedisys counterparty any longer. And then that creates a spiral.
Correct.
So the same thing on the clearing side. If we don't clear for them, it says Citi's got concerns. If we don't novate, or be clear late. If you slow down their payments, it makes it appear that you are, for some reason, holding back. And most often people are going to think it's you have credit concerns. The same thing with the novations. So we had conversations with them. We're getting a lot of these novations. We don't want to turn them down, because that'll just take a situation that may be struggling and make it that much more challenging. And we had discussions not only with Lehman. We had discussions with Merrill Lynch, and we had discussions with Morgan Stanley on these same issues. We're seeing increased novations with the brokers who are under pressure, and we're taking them. But we want to make sure that you understand this is not risk that we're really want to take, and we ended up, you know, taking collateral from multiple companies on both sides, clearing and novations.
Let me, a couple of questions on that. The timing of the increased novations, and if you recall, who they were, who was getting out?
I know I wrote them down in an email that was made public. I don't recall the names. I'm sorry. Actually, when I saw the names in the examiner's report, I was like, oh my God, we put these in the report.
They had promised to redact them.
Okay. But the names are in there.
Operational error.
So the names, so it's sort of that those clients would be very sensitive for them to get out. There were probably 6 or 7 hedge funds. A lot of times hedge funds will see, they'll seek to novate just as a test. You know, is Citi still open? Is J.P. Morgan open? And this is the way that they prepare themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So if they find that J.P. Morgan and Citi and Bank of New York and Bank of America are no longer accepting novations, something's up. Maybe I need to do something different myself.
And again, the timing of when you're seeing the increase in novations?
It was sort of followed CNBC, I think. You know, the bad things came out and everybody was running, right? People were very concerned. The stock price was dropping.
Mm-hmm.
And
CNBC, so what's the timing of CNBC?
I don't know when that is. Just to help orient, you had the meeting on June 5th.
Yes.
They actually accelerated their earnings and to the 9th.
Right.
While you had focused on liquidity, the world focused on the write-down, and there was a lot of problems. The COO and CFO are removed.
That's right,
on the 12th.
Yeah, that was sort of a bad day for them and for the market and everyone.
Let me start. Is it this June 2008 time frame where you're seeing the increase in novations?
It's actually June 12th.
Yeah.
I mean, you will see, or you've seen documents,
right.
Or you might see documents, or we can direct you to documents that would indicate there was like a threefold increase.
That was a really bad day. The day the announcement of the seniors being either redeployed in the company or let go was a terrible day for the company.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw
So the 9th was a Friday, and the 12th is a Monday? Is that?
I believe.
Okay.
And we saw a lot of novations come in, and for the first time I made a decision that said we're not going to take any more.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because, you have to protect your own firm as well. So while you want to try not to cause more stress with the client struggling, you also got to remember that, I'm here to protect Citi. So I wrote an email at that point saying, we cannot take any more novations.
And who did you write the email to?
To my seniors.
Okay.
That's also, we can have a follow-up where I give you, tab numbers to the
She knows all the tab numbers. I don't.
Okay. Describe to us the atmospherics that day, who you talked to at Lehman and what they came back with.
Yeah, I think, probably three of us, myself, Michael Malmsteen, and Chris Fusket, they were the relationship management side. The three of us got on the phone, and we spoke probably, and I would believe that we probably spoke to Ian.
Mm-hmm.
We were probably speaking to Dan Fleming daily, right? Because Dan was the cash guy. So if we had a negative balance, we wanted to know where the cash was coming from. So lots of conversations to help us understand how we were going to be made whole before the end of the day on the cash side. So Dan Fleming was probably a daily, if not multiple times during the day throughout June.
On the 12th, do you have a specific recollection of who you spoke to?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't. I could just say probably because those are the guys our primary contact.
So you were in constant contact with Dan Fleming?
Okay.
On cash, and then we would have had a number of us had calls. I mean, Chris Fosquet probably had some calls without me. He was a senior relationship person.
And what was the ask on the 12th? So what were
what did you initially request from Lehman Brothers?
So you'd kind of turned off novations.
Yes.
And we can show you the emails that show they turned off novations. They were cutting lines back to about $5 billion across the world. They were concerned that they wouldn't be able to clear within that amount without alerting the market. Of course, if you don't take novations, it's going to alert the market. Nobody's comfortable. We don't want to make Lehman fail. So
right. Well, let me give
you
a little more background on the clearing. We had $20 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And $20 billion, there's amounts in Japan, there's amounts in countries in Europe, and then there's in North America. What we had decided to do at that time was we need to reduce to $20 billion. So we went into a very manual process of managing the clearing lines. So what we said was when Japan closes, we're going to take that dollar amount and use it in another country. Typically, when Japan would close, that clearing dollar amount would close with them. So if there was $1 billion approved in Japan, when Japan closed, it stayed there. So I had to approve a separate $1 billion to open in New York. So we decided that we would now go into a manual environment where we would then take countries as they close and use those dollars. So we were able to reduce the clearing to a much smaller number with having minimal client impact. So the $20 billion we tried to manage down to a much smaller number. But then there was a number that we couldn't get below.
Mm-hmm.
And given the clearing risk, the intraday risk, which has a real likelihood of going overnight, and given the novations, we decided that we need to ask for, at a minimum, this deposit.
And what was that amount initially?
Well, there was some debate. I mean, I know that at one point the relationship team went in and they asked for $500 million, whereas the risk team was thinking $5
billion. Mm-hmm.
So, you had Ryan Leach and Fontana discussing that the $5 billion was about the right range, and then I become aware that Fosquet and the client were talking about $500 million. So we went in for...
Let me stop you for a minute.
Yeah.
And I apologize, but
no need.
I'm not in this business. I'm not from the street, so sometimes it goes over my head. I understand there was a $20 billion clearing line, and you're reducing that beginning on the 12th, it sounds like. First question is, what do you reduce it to?
Well, we can show you the emails that do that. But
okay.
It's like, and it's like reducing it to a billion in U.S. and 500 million over in Asia and 500 over there. And what it means, to have a clearing line means automatically, if they're trying to transfer money or you need a draw on money, that can happen without human intervention, because even if there's no money in the account, because it goes to the clearing line.
Right.
So you figure out it's only once you get to, once you've busted through the clearing line of whatever it is, a billion, 3 billion, that it goes for an excess approval. And
correct.
That would come up to you or people under you
correct.
That would then bring it up to you. So it doesn't mean that that's where you stop.
Right.
It means that's where you take notice. So I believe those numbers in aggregate, my recollection is on the 12th, that at least for a moment in time, it came down pretty dramatically to about 3 billion worldwide, which...
So down from 20 to 3?
Yes, except I guess what Tom's trying to say is that if Asia's closed, you can put all of that in the U.S.
Correct.
And what that means is not that you don't clear their accounts, but that he has to know what in the world's going on when you're going over
right.
that amount.
So when a client sends us an instruction,
when
a client sends us an instruction to send out money, it goes into the platform that we manage the cash movements with. First thing it does is it checks the account for balances. So if the client wants to send out $100 and there's $100 in the account, it goes. No one ever looks at it. The client wants to send out $100 and there's only $50 account in the account, it looks to see if there's a credit line on their account. And if the two added together are greater than the amount, it goes. If it then gets to a point where the amount of credit and the amount of the monies in the account are less than what the client wants to send out, it stops and it gets held up in a queue. And then people reach out to the risk organization, my team, to say, will you approve an excess for Lehman of X dollars? And if it's large, we're going to call the client. We've got $1 billion request to send money to J.P. Morgan. Where's it coming from? Where's the cover coming from? The client says, got money over at B of A, should be there in the next hour. Typically, it goes out.
So is what happening is on the 12th that backup credit line is reduced?
So what's happening?
So the trigger is at a lower amount.
That's correct.
Correct.
So
we.
So what is that reduced from to?
Something around 20 billion to something around 3 billion, and it sounds more dramatic because the way we typically approve lines is we just give every country a line,
mm-hmm.
and when they close, the line sits there. So we probably could have managed easily with less than $10 billion had we been more efficient in the use of our lines. But because the systems, they don't all talk to each other electronically. When Japan closed, we have to manually move that line.
And on June 12th, do you tell Lehman we're going to reduce the backup lines from 20 to 3?
We probably don't. The lines are uncommitted, and the lines tend to be unadvised. So we are clearing their activity. That's what they're focused on. They don't really care about how much our lines are. So we probably, I'm not sure on June 12th that we told them that. And it wasn't long after that when then we actually were telling them we're reducing our lines to the amount of the deposit held. So I'm not sure if it was exactly then. So.
Go ahead.
I forget what I was going to say.
It'll come to you.
So if it was important, as my mother would say.
And so, since we're on June 12th, on that day, do you also tell Lehman that you're not going to be doing any more novations?
Yes. They were very unhappy. So, that's when we started getting into discussions that, we need to be, they need to give us more comfort so that we can help them.
So let me ask you then. So on June 12th, 1 week, Citi tells Lehman no more novations. 2, Citi tells Lehman we want a comfort deposit. And you'll tell me what the amount was and what was worked out. And 3, even though Citi's reducing the backup line from 20 to 3, maybe or maybe not, that comes up on the 12th.
And the only thing that it really is a moment in time that it's at 3, because it goes up to 10 after the 2 billion comes in.
Okay, and when you say it goes back up to 10, do you mean the backup line, or do you mean it's still
a
3, but the exception report comes
in
and you say, okay,
I mean
go
the lines.
Okay.
So there's some fluctuation. If you're interested in the actual chronology of where the lines are at what time, we can probably direct you. Okay.
So back from 3 back up to 10 once you get the, I believe, $2 billion comfort.
And it's real time, right?
But so is that right? After you get, because of the $2 billion comfort deposit?
And novations get turned
right.
on.
And right.
And this is all very quickly happening, so it's not, you know, there's weeks going by where we're not accepting novations. This is, real time on the phone talking to client about.
So at this time, on June 12th, when Citi is reducing its exposure to Lehman on both the clearing side and the novation side, is there thought within Lehman, within Citi, by you or anyone else that I think Lehman may be going down? And that, and I don't know that the government's going to prevent them from going down.
I'd actually refer you to two emails in the Examiner report.
You
emailed Foskett, the quote, internal team has lost confidence in Lehman. No telling what will happen. In another paragraph, you say, market is saying Lehman cannot make it alone. Loss of confidence is huge here at the moment.
Yeah, this is the biggest risk that a financial institution has. You know, you can have any level of equity in all the liquid securities in the world. If the market moves and pulls the liquidity out of you faster than you can liquidate, you're in trouble.
Right. And I understand that. I understand there's concern within Citi that Lehman's in trouble, and that's why you're reducing your exposure to Lehman. I'm asking sort of the next level. I mean, remember we're sort of...
There is no way in my mind that I ever thought the government's bailing me out, I don't have to worry.
Mm.
Now, I am making decisions solely on the basis of, can Lehman make it? And, you know, how do I protect my firm as we go through this process?
When you talk to Lehman, and they gave you facts, not assumptions about whether they were going to survive or not, did you trust everything you were being told in terms of numbers? It sounds like an awful lot was taking place on the telephone.
Did we trust? For the most part, I would say yes. You know, if you go back a little history of Lehman, 1998, Lehman's coming through a terrible time. Everyone thinks that they've got all this Latin America debt and that Lehman's done. And, you know, Lehman's saying, no one understands us. We don't have those positions. The company comes through it. And so Lehman has a pattern of not having the degree of risk that people tended to believe they had. So you fast forward to this time, and there were rumors that many companies hadn't written some of their real estate assets down to levels, and their CLOs and their CDOs and their asset-backed securities down to the levels that, you know, should be written at. Now, it's also a very difficult time to price a lot of this stuff. And if you would have asked, you know, two or three dealers to price one security, you'd probably have a very wide spread. So it was a tough time. We had nothing to believe that they were doing, you know, things wrong. We even had... and I may have the timing wrong. At some point, they asked us to do a repo against some of their assets. And we look at that assets, and we really don't like what we see. But even then, we don't know how much they've written those assets down. If the assets have been written down to 20 cents on the dollar, it's okay. If they carry them at 90, you know, we think it's worth 20, and that's a problem. But they don't tell us what they're carrying their assets at.
So let me ask you, in the June time frame, when Citi's reducing its exposure to Lehman through the novations, through the comfort deposit, through reducing the backup lines, can you give me some kind of ballpark quantification of what the exposure is going from and to? Are we down from a total of $20 billion to $10 billion, or what's the quantity?
Well, if you look at you almost have to look at the exposures completely different, right? Because you have the clearing stuff, which is big intraday movement, tends to be the lowest risk that we take. But it can, you know, flip on you. You can close today with no risk because they have positive balances in their account. Tomorrow, if you have $20 billion, and let's just say it was all in Japan, you know, I can wake up in New York and find that I have a negative in my accounts in Japan of $20 billion. And if they don't cover that, then that comes real risk, and you know that's the riskier. So clearing tends to be the shortest term, the lowest risk that you have. But it tended to be size. So you had a tail risk there, which you had to be very careful in how you manage it. And I always had said, and I still say, if my new role is managing this risk, right? If our heads aren't in the sand, We should see clients as they're struggling, and we should be able to manage that risk down. We should not lose money on clearing. If we do it, if we're not paying attention to the market, we could lose money, but we shouldn't. And if you look at history, Citi has almost never lost money. I think we lost, you know, $5 million in the last 20 years on clearing.
And to get to your question of kind of numerical, like what was it and where did it, how much was it reduced? Mm-hmm. I think as Tom was saying before, it's tough to really say the $20 billion in lines was really hard risk.
But I get that.
Right, because the lines were also sized so that against the highest.
Right.
So that you wouldn't have to manually intervene. So I don't know that you could say that we had $20 billion of exposure that we then reduced, but essentially.
And we never did.
Let me
never had 20.
And I get that. So, but a potential $20 billion of exposure may not, you know, be really being reduced. But by reducing the lines, we're going to get triggers earlier to see if we need to deal with it. Is sort of the issue, right?
I
get that, and I know. So I understand that, making it difficult to quantify how the exposure is different. It's really just changing the triggers and when you have to look at what your exposures are. And I understand that, thank you. But what about, and you were talking about, you wanted to talk about the different kinds of accounts, and you've talked about how clearing exposure is low risk one day, but can also flip on you really quick and it's large. What about the other kinds of exposure?
Well, that's my next point. The novations and, you know, the business with the major brokers and banks tends to be secured. So to the extent that we have derivatives on with Lehman's and we're taking on more derivatives through novations, at the end of the day, we make a call for collateral, they make a call on us. So generally, you know, your risk there becomes, if the market moves dramatically, will they be there to make the next call on the collateral? So, you know, while we're taking on more novations, it increases the risk of that portfolio. You know, you are going, their accounts were all margin, so we would be calling for collateral. That time was also a very difficult time because pricing these portfolios became a challenge.
Other than the clearing and the novation risk, is there other risk that we're reducing, that Citi's reducing its exposure to? Lehman?
Are you buying CDS on Lehman?
Well, one of the things that we had historically done, we would buy CDS. I don't know that we're buying CDS at that time.
I think
we already had it.
You did.
We already had it. I don't, because that time would have been.
Yes. No. You definitely.
We had it already.
My understanding, we can go to an exposure chart, but essentially, Citi was in a couple of revolvers of Lehman's. But Lehman never, those are the CP revolvers, and so if they can't turn their CP, then they might pull on them, so they're liquidity backstops. So we're in them along with a slew of other banks. They never actually pulled on those, and so that's kind of committed exposure, but it wasn't hard exposure at the moment. We did have some loans that were extant, like real loans, one to Hong Kong, you know, that were guaranteed by Lehman, that were to different Lehman entities. And there was probably about, you know, $400 million of real.
Unsecured.
And I believe that going into this situation, you may have had about 310, 350 in CDS. And I know by the end of the day, you were up to at least 390. So I think you were in the market for CDS if the pricing was.
When you say the end of the day, you mean the week before?
I'm sorry.
Right,
yeah.
September.
The demise.
So we would buy CDS to hedge the exposure that we had. Typically, we'd be most focused on the loan book because that was unsecured. Mm-hmm. So we would have. That's a normal course of action, right? You know, as the risk manager, I'm also needing to look at how I can mitigate my risk. And so if I have unsecured risk with a name that, you know, pretty much with every name, because not only does it reduce risk, but it reduces the assets that you have. So we would buy CDS to reduce risk, and we might buy CDS to create capacity for other types of business with the client. Because we got a benefit to the extent that we had CDS, the amounts of our outstandings would be reduced, and that would create more capacity to do other things.
But this was a time that triggered basically looking at the market and seeing if we could get CDS at a decent
price. Yeah, I'm sure the price went up after June 9th.
The price was all over. Right? I think it was normally somewhere around 50 to 70, and then it's 250, 400, and then it came back down, and then it went back up. So we look at the CDS price regularly. We still do, right? I have, on a daily basis, I have my team runs the CDS spreads for all of our top accounts.
Right.
It's just an external market to see what does the market think of these clients.
So back to June 12th, can you walk us through the negotiations around the deposit, how much you initially proposed? Did you propose cash versus collateral, and what Lehman came back with?
Well, there was initial discussion, which was with Chris Foskett, which was for a very small amount, and we immediately said, no, wrong number, and we went back out saying we won $5 billion. And then the negotiations ended up with us taking $2 billion.
And that was in cash. Did you initially propose cash?
Okay. Yes, initially we said cash, and that was what we had with Bear, so it was a normal thing for us. Let's take a cash deposit. It's clean, it's easy, and there's no debates and discussion and prolonged negotiations on, you know, how do you value a security if it wasn't, you know, anything else other than cash.
And why wasn't this deposit reduced to writing? You had mentioned that the Bear Stearns deposit was in writing.
I think we felt that we felt very good in terms of the benefits that we would get just from the New York State law that you have a right to set off against a deposit,
mm-hmm.
And the client had historically, all the brokers, would guarantee their subs. So the holding companies tended to guarantee their subsidiaries. They'd guarantee them all other than the primary operating company. So the holding company would not typically guarantee the broker because we didn't really need that. That's where all the value of the entity was. So we enter into this at this time, we're in a situation where we have a guarantee from the holding company
mm-hmm.
of many of the entities that we deal with. And so we asked for a deposit at the holding company level, knowing that we had good rights to set other exposures off against that deposit.
Now, the comfort deposit, the term is one day, right? And it just keeps rolling every day?
The term of the deposit was one day, which is what Lehman needed. Mm-hmm. And the instructions that the people who managed the deposit, the treasury desk, had from me was, should Lehman call to ask for the deposit, that they had to call me. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that was, it's Lehman's money. They can take it anytime they want, right? It's not collateral. It's their money. If they wanted the money, we were going to give it back. But then that might cause me to behave differently on the lines that we had.
And
we wouldn't close them down, but we might say, you know, we're going to reduce our clearing lines, and now they need to pre-fund their account if they want to move monies out.
So how did the one-day term of the comfort deposit, I'm wondering how the set-off provision gives you comfort when the term's one day and they can snag it pretty much any time they want.
I think you'll find a lot of emails saying, this doesn't give us any comfort at all. Oh. You could yank it at any moment.
So it's a misnomer. It's a discomfort deposit.
I don't know if you know about the mechanics of call accounts, but essentially it's a one day, and if they ask for it on any particular day, they have to get it, I think, by Fed closing
right.
at 6 o'clock, you know, through the wire.
It wouldn't have been possible, for example, if Lehman called and said, I want my comfort deposit back. Citi's response couldn't have been, we're going to invoke the set-off, right?
I don't know if that's true. If our balances in their accounts were negative $1 billion, and they wanted their $2 billion back,
mm-hmm.
I think we would have had a long discussion and got legal on the phone to say, we want to make sure our billion negative is covered.
Okay.
So I think there would have been discussion around what our rights are, and I think we had the rights to set off the $1 billion against.
Do you think Lehman had the same understanding, that you had the right of set off? It looks from the examiner report that they understood it to be a goodwill gesture.
We will refer you to...
Not all of them, right?
We will refer you to meeting notes taken by Emil Cornejo at a mm-hmm. meeting that I think Paolo Tunici attended. It may have been either August 8th or the 17th, but they're talking about the deposit, and it says... there's two versions of this, but it says a note, Citi has set off rights under New York law. There's also an email on September 14th where someone, these we only got access to it from you know, Jenner has the whole thing up on its website with a hyperlink to every document. So mm-hmm. it's the first time we got to see Lehman's documents. But we can give them to you. There's also an email on the 14th, right before Lehman filed, where an internal person at Lehman, asking.
It can't be the head of investment.
I don't could have think been. So. Yes. I think it's a lawyer. Hugh Reese.
Thank you.
Is asking Emil, that $2 billion at Citi, are there any liens on it? And he said, mm-hmm. well, not exactly liens, but they have a right of set off under New York law. So.
Yeah.
But back to June, though, did you have that discussion regarding the set off when you initially requested for it?
I don't recall that having that discussion.
So you probably had two different views as to what the deposit actually was.
We would submit that every bank has a right of set off under New York law, and that if you don't know it, you should learn your law.
Yeah, it's something that we just always grew up with, right? Mm-hmm. We know that we have a deposit under New York law, we have this right of set off. So inside a city, it's sort of common knowledge. Mm-hmm. I would have thought that inside of a major broker that they would have some understanding. Dan Fleming must have known that.
So
that was his business.
Given the flurry of emails about this provides no comfort at all, since it's got the one-day term, explain to me why the one-day term is agreed to, and I guess ultimately who within Citi makes the decision to agree to the one-day term.
I think we were able to convince people. You know, at this point, it's not just risk and relationship managers. We also have our legal team, and we're talking to them about, you know, where do they think we are. So, you know, our legal team is saying that, you know, with this deposit, you have a solid claim, and we convince our seniors that this is okay, an okay environment or structure to move forward with.
So, who ultimately had to say okay within Citi?
Well, me first, Brian Leach second.
I think we should talk about the request to have real collateral and that there's a parallel
right.
track.
This is coming into July and August.
Yeah, we then have a meeting with Lehman, and I don't know the exact date.
Before we move away from the $2 billion deposit, liquidity pool, did you know that Lehman included the $2 billion in its liquidity pool?
I think, you know, I'm at the moment I'm not recalling that I knew that. Ultimately, we know that,
mm-hmm.
And that's why they don't want it pledged.
Because
I think at the first day, I probably don't know that.
Yeah.
But then as there's a point in time when we want to go pledge, and they're telling us, well, then that has issues to us, and we don't want that. Mm-hmm. But I think on the first day we get it, I don't know that, or I didn't think it that through at that time.
Do you think the market knew that?
The market probably has no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's a deposit that they have at Citi. That's all the market would know.
Mm-hmm.
The market doesn't even know that. They know they have cash, and they know the cash is held in banks,
right.
And they don't know where the cash is held.
And realistically, how fast could Lehman have monetized that? You said within 24 hours.
The $2
billion? The $2 billion.
If they would have called me at 4 o'clock on any day, they would have had that money before 6.
And what would be the effect?
The effect would be that before giving it to them, I would look at what my current balances were.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if I'm negative, we're going to have a discussion about first you got to clear up the negative balances, because if I give you the $2 billion and you go out of business and I'm then short $1 billion, I look pretty foolish. Mm-hmm. And then we need to think about how do I operate it open for you in Japan in, you know, 6 or 7 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the issue, right? If we wanted to make sure we had comfort and we work with them on a global basis, it's one thing for me to give them money back in New York and have those accounts be flat, but then how do I open for them with a credit line in Japan?
Mm-hmm.
And I probably would have said that I'm not going to have a credit line in Japan, and you need to fund your account if you want to move cash or have us buy securities.
Now, did Citi include that $2 billion in its own liquidity pool? Or?
No, it was a deposit that we held, so it would be a liability and count towards the deposits held by Citi. So.
When other clients that you clear for, I mean, historically, and they were smaller, but when they got in trouble, what did you have them do?
Well, I think our behavior has always been the same, right? The first thing that we do is we manage lines down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, eventually we will tell clients, you know, you need to pre-fund your account. And, you know, when things get really bad, we say post no debits. So do not permit any money to go out of the account without getting some pre-approvals. So there's sort of a number of steps. You know, first, you start reducing the lines. You manage more efficient. You go manual. As things get worse, you may then say, I need some sort of deposit or I need some collateral. As things get worse, you're saying, you know, post no debits to this account, and ultimately you close the account. So you manage it down, and your whole control environment tightens.
So between March and September 2008, did you hold other similar deposits from investment banks?
Yes, not as early as March. I think that, we had Bear, then we had Lehman, and probably in September, you know, and I don't know exactly when, probably sometime early September, we took collateral from Morgan Stanley, from Nomura, from Dexia, so other companies we were having the same discussions.
Do you remember the amounts for?
Morgan Stanley, I think, was a total of $3 billion. And Morgan Stanley was a little bit more structured in that they had two separate documents. They had one document for the clearing risk and a separate document and a separate amount for the novations and the derivative exposure. Whereas Lehman didn't have us distinguish between the two. Morgan said, wait, I want two documents. I want to make sure that you've got $1 billion was the number for novations and $2 billion was for the clearing.
And in the June 2008 time frame, comfort deposits from any institutions other than Lehman?
Only Lehman.
Only Lehman.
We met with Merrill. We've told them. You know, at the time, we were meeting with everybody. We're meeting with everybody, and we're talking to them about what our actions are stepping, how we will behave as the situation gets worse. So we met with Merrill. We met with Morgan, and we had the same exact conversation that we had with Lehman, you know, weeks earlier. That we're getting concerned, you know, we've got this large amount of exposure, and at some point we're going to make a request for collateral. We got there with Morgan. We ended up not ever getting there with Merrill because of the B of A progress in negotiations.
So when you got there with Morgan and the other companies you mentioned just a minute ago, was that post-Lehman bankruptcy in September?
I think they were all post, because then the crisis and sort of tailspins out of control.
So it wasn't post, for example, GSE conservatorship over Labor Day weekend?
No.
Okay.
All right. Now through July and August, can you walk us through the move towards the pledge agreements replacing the $2 billion cash with collateral?
Well, Lehman was eager to get cash back. I guess that probably gave him the most value. Mm-hmm. And we were open-minded to consider taking something else. However, it had to be something that we could value and be able to get out of very easily, because obviously we increase our risk to the extent that we give them, you know, more benefit and not and underestimating what the haircut would be in terms of, you know, a price move when you go to liquidate. Mm-hmm. So they started giving us the negotiations were way too long. Mm-hmm. You know, they were slow to give us portfolios. They'd give us portfolios that we would never go into accept.
The portfolio you got was on about August 8th. And it was a portfolio of CLOs.
Okay.
And I don't know if that helps you recall what the issues were. I mean, you looked at the CLOs.
Yeah, we looked at it, and we realized that this is not a portfolio that we would want to take. It was a very hard portfolio to price. And
what was their valuation in that portfolio?
Oh, I don't recall.
Did Lehman ever tell you what they were valued?
Oh, they didn't tell us theirs. You know, okay. Our guys looked at it and said, tough to price. This is not something we should be taking as collateral, because if we have to liquidate it, I don't know where we're going to be able to, what we'll be able to get.
But generally, after the $2 billion cash comfort deposit is provided in June of 2008. Shortly after that, Lehman is requesting, negotiating with Citi to say, look, we want our cash, we'll give you securities or non-cash assets instead.
But it was very slow. It took a long time.
And the first time they even present you with any alternative to cash is in this August 2008 time frame, where they give you a listing of CLOs.
Yes.
And just to complete the picture, and you can see it in the documents the examiner himself cites, the issue Lehman had with the deposit as articulated to us was that they took a cash capital charge of something like 300 basis points. That they said, if we're not earning, they're earning Fed funds minus an eighth. And they said that elsewhere, like in money market funds or whatever, they could be earning a whole lot more. So that's the concern that they kept articulating to Citi. Citi kept saying, well, if you give it to us term, you know, for a week or for a month, we can give you higher rates, but this is what we give for one day. And they refused to tie it up. So there's a lot of talk about how they could get more value. Like, they didn't like the return they were getting.
Okay, so that's actually, to me, I don't know if it's important, but it's interesting.
Well,
so they don't want the cash back, they want a better yield?
At least that's the story they're telling.
Well, no, but Tom, they're also selling you cash every night.
Oh, yeah, most often we have more than $2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
They can, you know, they, at the end of the day, they need to put their cash somewhere.
Right.
And, you know, we're a top clearing bank. Let's show Citi that we have more liquidity than just the $2 billion. Right. So, you know, it's a little bit of a game, right? If all we ever see is $2 billion and they're struggling, mm-hmm. you know, we see negative accounts. So they want to show us we have more liquidity than this, and we were closing frequently above the $2 billion.
So there's never an articulation, correct me, that we need this money to function. It was, we don't like what we're earning on this money. So,
yeah, the money was going to be left in a bank somewhere, you know, so, you know, they might have been able to make more someplace else. You know, we were sort of getting in their way of maximizing the use of that.
So these CLOs were pledged to J.P. Morgan?
I don't know that.
Okay,
now you're jumping.
Oh, okay.
We don't know that, right? They showed us a portfolio. We looked at it. If we would have gotten comfort, then we might have substituted. But you know, if it was U.S. Treasuries, I'm certain we would have gotten there.
Mm-hmm.
But CLOs and that environment, remember the environment that we're in, is an environment where it's difficult to price CLOs and a lot of other stuff.
Did you ever have a conversation, for example, after you get the portfolio of CLOs in August of 2008, if you want a better yield, why don't you sell your CLOs and go put it where you want to put it to get a better yield?
No, no, we didn't have that conversation. It's still a relationship, one that we still think is going to turn the corner, right? We're still not in a situation where we think they're done. We're still thinking that it's a really tough time, but they will come back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, everything gets continually getting worse and worse as opposed to stabilizing and getting better.
Okay, and I think you covered this, but when you get the portfolio of CLOs in August of 2008, it sounds like Citi says, nah, we don't want that instead of $2 billion.
Yeah, well, what we do is we bring that to our guys to a desk and say, take a look at these assets, because it's not my job to price CLOs.
Mm-hmm.
And they come back and say, tough to price, you know, this is a tough portfolio for us to take, and if you're going to take it as collateral, you're in a high-risk position.
But was there talk about taking it with substantial haircuts, or was
no,
it just...
No, we weren't going to take that risk.
Okay.
Did they come back with a different portfolio?
Well, did you tell Lehman we're not interested in the CLOs?
Absolutely.
Okay. And thereafter, they come back with a different set of assets?
One further pool.
Okay.
Which was a kind of, it was an asset-backed pool mostly with second liens.
And what was the date on that, do you remember?
It was pretty
late.
Late
August.
It was,
it's
getting late.
August was getting tired.
The thing was really, really mm-hmm. stretched out.
Right.
So get the first portfolio in August, maybe get August 8th, get back to them within a week or 10 days. To tell them we can't price it and we don't think it's liquid. So they give us another portfolio to look at. I don't think there's any feedback from us going to JPM, I'm sorry, going
Lehman.
To Lehman before they're in crisis.
Mm.
Yeah. At least I haven't seen.
You would have seen.
So
that
I'm
it
sure
was.
So their second proposal, you never got back to them.
No, I think just the window was just collapsing on us.
Okay.
Then.
And is that because you submitted the ABS portfolio to your guys, and they just hadn't finished with their evaluation before everything started?
Yeah,
to
I think that was it. I mean, everyone's doing lots of things at the time. You know, we're sitting on a $2 billion in cash, which is probably the best we're going to be in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're giving us, you know, sort of. Know, portfolios that were not liquid and high risk and not a reasonable substitution in the current environment.
All right. So going to September 5th, it looks like Citi downgrades its internal classification of Lehman's creditworthiness. What effect did that have?
It was rated at 2.
Yeah, no. So then it becomes a substandard asset. So we move from the 1A special mention to a 2, which is substandard from sort of the regulatory definition. It means that their internal risk ratings go to a 7+. So typically we risk rate from a 1 to a 10, 1 being AAA, 10 being...
What effects on Lehman?
Almost nothing. Like, no, it just means, you know, that we think the situation is getting worse,
mm-hmm.
And there is no that the classification itself is not going to trigger anything that we're not already doing.
Okay.
So on September 5th, Citi downgrades Lehman's risk profile from special mention to substandard, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that the impact of that, I think I hear you saying, isn't much, at least in terms of, it doesn't mean the comfort deposit goes to $3 billion.
September 4th, we were thinking they were bad, and September 5th, we say, let's get this done into the system, because if you don't do this, then your auditors at some point are going to say, how come you waited so long to classify them worse?
Mm.
So we're already managing them as if they're substandard. It's not like on that day is a whole change in our approach. You know, we're managing them closely. We're looking at clearing in a manual environment. We're concerned, and we're looking at daily novations. We're doing our behavior didn't change because they went from special mention to substandard.
You just said something that I found curious. You said you're dealing with daily novations. I thought Citi wasn't doing novations.
No, we started up again after we took the deposit.
Mm. Right? Okay.
There was only one day where we said we're not going to take them again.
If Citi was not taking Lehman
risk, it would have been a lot sooner.
Would have been bankrupt the next day.
Let me ask you something on that then. I mean, did you know if any other I understand that's a negative message to the market, clearly.
Right.
Were there any other clearing banks or any other counterparties that usually were doing novations for Lehman that weren't? Were you hearing that on the street?
No. I don't think we've heard of anybody not accepting them. Doesn't mean it wasn't happening, right? And we get into later in 08, we have the situation where, you know, clients are saying no to Citi, right? And so, you know, at that point, then what do? We call the clients and we say, well, what are you doing? Let us give you some comfort. So typically when you learn that someone's novating away from you, you want to talk to them and give them the comfort and walk them through the story. So I think I don't know that others were saying no. My assumption is if Goldman and J.P. Morgan and Morgan Stanley would all say no, the situation would have spiraled out of control no matter what Citi did at a much faster rate. So I'm assuming that most people were still taking them.
So earlier you said, and I'm sorry to go back to June of 08, but when you told Lehman no more novations, they were very unhappy about that. That's what you said?
Correct. It was a bad signal for one of their lead banks to send.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, were they unhappy? Did they say that's a bad signal for one of our lead banks to send?
Yeah, and that's why we sort of moved forward with the cash deposit as quickly as we did.
Right. I mean, did they say that that's such a bad signal that it's the end of the game for us if the market finds out that Citi's not willing to do novations?
No, that wasn't. They didn't say that.
Did they say?
They asked us to give them the names of the clients that were novating, which we wouldn't do.
Right. Did they say anything like, you know, saying you're going to stop novations unless we get a comfort deposit is a no choice proposition for us? Of course, we have to say this.
We would never have made that threat, but we would just say we're taking on more risk than we're comfortable. And, you know, we want to continue to be a relationship, and we want to continue to support you, and the deposit helps us get there.
And I hear that, but that didn't answer my question. I mean, I understand you're not threatening them, but did they say, you know, like, geez, you guys, you know, if you're going to stop novations unless we give you a comfort deposit, you got to realize that's a no-choice proposition for us and that we have to give you that comfort deposit.
I know there was a difficult conversation with one of the relationship managers. I don't know if it was Fosquet or Malacine, but there was a tough discussion with the client, saying, you know, this will cause us increased issues. And, you know, you're in an environment when the stock price is going into single digits, and you don't know when it's going to stop. And, you know, like I said earlier, we're not thinking anybody's coming to bail them out, so you have to protect yourself. Mm-hmm. And others are running away, and you're taking their name. And you look pretty foolish if the next day they go bankrupt.
So on September 5th, when Citi formalizes the downgrade to substandard, even though, as you said, you're still managing the relationship as if they're substandard, at that point. Do you folks think that Lehman's going down? Or do you still just think it, they're just in a more troubled environment and they're going to pull through?
I forget the exact day of the Korean Development Bank walking away.
That was the 8th. Okay.
Until that day, we thought they were going to be okay.
Okay.
Right? Until that day, there's still hope. Mm-hmm. There's still promise. And we misread it. We thought that this company was still going to make it. Now, classified two names come back all the time, so it's not at a point where we're thinking it's over. Because if it was, we would have gone to a classified three or a four. We would go to a doubtful or a loss classification, not substandard.
And was one of the reasons you thought they were going to make it because you thought the Korean Development Bank was either going to acquire?
Yeah, we knew it was out there. We knew it was out there, and there was a significant amount of equity that would come in, and that would sort of stabilize things for them.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, we're still thinking, and I think the whole situation, the whole issue for them was loss of confidence, mm-hmm. right? And so the market doesn't know how bad things are going to get, and every day it seems to be getting worse and worse and worse, and it feeds on itself. But there's this hope. There's a potential investor out there,
Now, when did you first start thinking about adding LBI and other subs to the 2004 LBHI? Guarantee agreement.
I think then we're getting later into the process. Yeah. It might have been right after the.
Yeah, well, walk us through the 5th through the 8th.
I think that's when we learned that the investor that called the last investor that we were aware of decides not to make their investment, and the market generally in Citi felt as well that they had done some due diligence. They had seen the inside. They had got to see what the assets, how they were priced, where they were marked, and they were not comfortable with what they saw. And so that investor then pulling back now sends the market into a tailspin for Lehman. Mm-hmm. Because it was some firm got inside, looked at the books, looked at the assets, and said, we don't like what we see. And, at that point, they're able to, make an investment at a very cheap price.
Mm-hmm.
And despite that, they decide not to.
And just to be clear, you're making the assumption that they got in, they did the...
Oh, yeah, we're making that assumption. We don't know that to be fact.
Right.
Through the weekend until...
Yeah, they were talking with this company for a while. It wasn't like it was one day due diligence. They were doing something, we assume.
So that was the last straw, Katie.
That seemed to be the last straw for us.
And then, so let me ask you, I don't know if this was public at the time, but I certainly see in the Valukas report that there were a lot of folks that were looking at Lehman well before September of 08, really since Bear went down in March. That seemed to be, if you believe the Valukas report, somewhat of a turning point for Lehman internally saying, okay, we really do need to get someone to make a substantial investment in us or acquire us outright. And so it looks like negotiations were going on post-Bear until the bitter end.
We didn't know that, right? A lot of it's private. Now, the only one that they made public that I recall is this one, the Korean company. But other discussions were sort of internal discussions, so I'm not aware of those. It would have surprised me that something happened before then.
And before September 9th, the September 9th, I think, or 8th or 9th announcement that the KDB deal wasn't going to go down, did you know KDB was looking at Lehman before that?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe they might have mentioned that at their second quarter announcement that they had this the Korean Development Bank looking at.
Yeah, it looks like on September 8th, Lehman was sharing its third quarter results with Citi. Is that standard procedure?
No, that was...
Did you ask for it, or did they volunteer?
That was volunteering to try to get us comfort. Right, so they sensed that we were getting increasingly concerned.
Uh-huh.
And so they said, come in, we'll have a senior meeting, we'll walk you through our numbers, and confidentially we'll give you insight into what the quarter will look like.
Were you in that meeting?
Yes.
Who else was there?
I would just assume, Mao was seeing Foskett, me, and I think Brian Leach, although Brian may not have been there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you recall. I'm sure you do. It's in the documents.
And who from Lehman?
It was probably Ian.
If it helps you, that's when they describe SpinCo to you.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if that
it's not
going
to help me remember who's there.
Right. No. To you. Okay.
And what was discussed in that meeting?
Well, they gave us, you know, sort of their plan, what the quarter should look like, what their liquidity position was. So the basic sort of fundamentals, and the story is still not all that negative. They're then discussing, you know, sort of a good bank, bad bank type of setup, where, you know, you take the broker, keep it clean, take the commercial real estate and put it in a separate vehicle. Looks a lot like what Citi has done, right, the same type of setup. We hadn't done it until more recently, but you know, so that was a normal structure. When banks went bad, you'd always heard good bank, bad bank. You know, sort of separate the bad from the overall organization and show the strength of this company, this core business that can survive. And sure. So we had that type of thought.
And did that provide any comfort, or did it provide more concern, or what did it?
Well, you know what the fundamentals, yes, you could say, you know, it provided comfort. The problem wasn't, you know, what the fundamentals and whether that structure could work or not. It was how the market was going to react and the loss of confidence. You know, because a lot of things are happening. You're having clients novate. You're having clients have more restrictive terms. Clients want more margin on derivatives. Client wants bigger haircuts on repos. Everything's working against them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and the traditional bank, runs come when deposits leave. Mm. Yeah, and here, runs are coming in many different fashions. Right? You see the liquidity being pulled out from some of the prime brokerage accounts. It's smaller than there, but still it has there. You see repo haircuts going from 2 to 3 to 5 to 6. And all that costs the client, you know, liquidity and equity. And that hurts. So it we walk out of there, I think, feeling better, but recognizing it may be out of their control. The market may still react such that it's out of their desk, out of their control.
And what Tom has told me, that the focus was they were going to announce this SpinCo without the funding to do it.
Yeah, they didn't
so
have it all
worked
out.
They were going to say, we still need, you know, this is our concept, we can't execute.
You know, I think the situation hadn't happened before. I mean, you had the bear situation, but I think Lehman was probably not believing this was happening for too long.
But right. Certainly, in terms of the meeting on a sneak peek at the 3Q08 results in the SpinCo plan, this is certainly before you guys hear about the KDB deal tanking.
I think that's true.
Monday.
Yes.
It's the night before.
Yeah. Right.
Did you know that Lehman was having similar conversations with JP Morgan?
No.
Okay. And when did you first think about amending the 2004 guarantee to include the subs to protect yourself?
You're going to want a date. I don't recall the exact date.
Was that before the meeting? With
the request was on the
9th. 9th, right.
And at least from our review of the documents and talking to Tom, there is absolutely no indication that there was discussion to do that beforehand.
Yeah, I didn't think I wouldn't know the exact date, but yes, we typically that, you know, what was not guaranteed was where we felt most comfortable. Mm-hmm. But now we're in such a tailspin that we're not certain that even in the strongest of the entities or the operating company where the assets were, that you're going to work out okay.
All right. So describe September 9th for us. It looks from the examiner report that you sent a contract to Lehman as leave it or take it or leave it, signed by 6 or else we won't clear for you. Just
well,
is that a fair assessment?
I mean, I don't know if it's a fair assessment. Completely fair.
Just one thing you should know. That was the standard guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of changes to it, but otherwise it was the guarantee of all the other subs. The other thing you should understand is CLS, which is a clearing thing that we do through a bank platform that only highly funded banks can enter. So we did it for Lehman. Lehman was not a member. They could only go through to us. At 6 p.m. at night, we have to commit to CLS for the next day's clearing, all of it. Billions of dollars trade through CLS. So at 6 p.m. that night, we were going to have to commit for
the next day
unguaranteed subsidiaries to do all that clearing where it's Citi's money, because we may have an indemnification from Lehman. But what's that worth if Lehman goes belly up the next day? So 6 p.m. is not an arbitrary deadline.
Mm-hmm.
It's a deadline we have to tell. Lehman's asking us to continue clearing through CLS Bank. At 6 p.m., we go on the hook with CLS Bank for everything. So the concern was that we've got this $2 billion comfort deposit but the way setoffs work, they have to be mutual, right? So if there's no guarantee of LBI, where we're gonna take on billions of dollars of clearing risk, if we have the exposure there, we can't set it off an LBHI deposit unless there is a guarantee of that. Mm-hmm. So it was the only way to essentially feel secured in taking on that exposure. CLS is hard to understand, and it wasn't. I think the examiner tried to do it, but just
continuous lint.
Can you just then describe to us what happened that day when you first proposed the amendment and what Lehman came back with?
Before you do that, is what triggers the request for the guarantee? The KDB deal, the sneak peek at the 3Q8 numbers, something else? What triggers?
Probably more the DKB deal, the KDB deal than anything else.
Okay.
Right? Because I think we probably wouldn't have done that just based on the sneak peek. And I think what we had done then was we said, where are we dealing with them? Let's go through all the subsidiaries and which ones are not currently covered, and let's get out to them a list of entities that we want now included under the existing guarantee. And that didn't include the broker dealers, which typically would not be covered or historically had not been covered.
And you guys, you know Lehman, so you know that on, like, I think their price fell by 45%. I think if you'll see in the documents that the request to have this guarantee was around noon. And for 6 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Can you just walk through negotiations? So around noon.
Do you remember, were you on the phone asking for the guarantee?
I wasn't on the phone. Me, Michael, Malice, and I were working together to come up with the list of entities, and then I think Michael sent an email over to Emil and maybe others as well, just saying, here are the names we need on the guarantee.
And what was your posture? What did you tell Lehman?
We need these done, otherwise we're going to...
By 6 p.m.
You're going to have to pre-fund your account. I mean, it's that simple. So, it's not that you can't clear through us, but you can't clear from us under a credit line. You need to clear through us with money in your accounts.
Okay. At this point, did your legal department have something drafted and you just attached that email to...
I think so. I mean, it wasn't that much of a change, right? We were giving them names, these, the following entities.
And how did Lehman react?
You'll see an email from Lehman. You'll see an email from us that says Lehman's fine about...
Yeah, they pushed some names off, accepted others.
So Lehman's fine about securing...
If Lehman... What would have been the real-world quantification impact if they said, the hell with the guarantee, we'll pre-fund our account? What would that have meant in terms of dollars for Lehman?
Well, they had $2 billion with us already, so that could have been used to pre-fund for themselves. It most likely would have resulted with more money being placed with Citi. Mm-hmm. Right, because the way the CLS works, we committed 6, and now when Japan opens, we're already committed to fund Japan. And so CLS works where you fund and the Japanese payments get made, and then you get the money back when the U.S. payments are made. So there's a long window of time where you short the money.
But do you have any idea? I mean, I know it's not an easy task, but I mean, what was the average amount of clearing on a day? I mean, what would they have had to come up with?
I think CLS alone would have been close to $1.5 billion to $2.5 billion, something like that. So
the comfort deposit would have covered that.
That only. But then you have securities clearing and cash clearing, so that would have just been the CLS component.
Right, and that's I'm just trying to understand what the implication would have been. What Lehman would have had to come up with.
If we had to tie up funds of theirs to cover CLS, they would have probably had to pre-fund accounts in Europe and North America, because the money on CLS, the dollars that cover the yen that we put out earlier, wouldn't have come back into till the end of the next day.
And ballpark, what is that number? I'm not going to hold you to it.
Yeah.
I get an idea, of what we're talking about.
I don't know if this gets at your question, but starting on the 8th, Citi would only be exposed up to the level of the deposit. So what that means is we were able to clear... with a lot of manual intensity, without going into pocket. I mean, if you pace when things are going out, we were able to do that within the $2 billion with a lot of gray hairs.
Yeah, a lot of things are getting stuck in queues.
So I don't know. I don't know if that gives you a sense, but you're really needing to be aware of where money's coming in and when it's coming in.
Timing issues and all that, right? Okay. So they probably maybe it wouldn't have had any impact as long as Citi kept doing the crazy manual processes to prevent having to access the backup lines.
Right. I mean, you might have been on the phone with Lehman. You need to put money here.
Right. That's what was happening. We would be calling Fleming. Right. You know, this account needs cover, and you get into that situation. I'm sure he was struggling with requests like that.
I'm sorry. Continue. Yep.
So you got the amendment back at 6 p.m. on that. Why was LBI not included in that initial amendment?
It was included in that one. It wasn't included
after
in the prior
six,
ones.
Though, right?
So why for the previous decade did you not have LBI included?
Yeah.
Is that the question?
Yeah.
Because they were the primary operating company. That was the strongest part of this company, right? The holding company is a shell, and they've got lots of subs. You know, the brokers in general, and Goldman guarantees their subs, but not their pre-broker, Morgan, this is the way they all behave. Well, guarantee everything other than the primary operating companies, and no one felt they needed that, because that's where the equity was, that's where the assets were, that's where the core business was. So now you're getting to a point where that company may not make it. We need to have it covered.
Mm-hmm. All right. 11th and the 12th. It looks like the DCA was amended on the 12th. What precipitated that?
The standard DCA has lien language in it that somehow over the years was negotiated either weaker or taken out completely. So typically it says, to the extent that we pay for securities, we put out the cash, we take in the securities, we have a claim on those securities until we get back your cash. So if I pay for the securities, I'm negative in my cash account that has now purchased this. The DCA typical language says we have a lien on those securities. And over the years, that was taken off. And I think because, you know, to some degree, Lehman had some proprietary assets, some client assets, and it was complicated for them. So over the years, that lien was lifted, and we had no claim like that. So now we're in a situation where we're still trying to continue to support them, and having that lien language back in gives us greater comfort.
And coming to that weekend, was it your thought that Lehman was seriously in trouble as in bankruptcy, or...?
You know, we were getting closer, but I still didn't think bankruptcy. And I didn't think government bailout either. I still thought somebody would be combined with Lehman. Mm-hmm. You know, you sort of saw the weekend with Bear Stearns. Someone came in. Lehman was the fourth largest broker in the world. You would have thought there'd be someone who would say, you know, at $2 price, it's a good combination, but it just didn't happen.
Now, it looks like Citi was in the consortium that Lehman weakened. Were you involved in the valuations of the commercial real estate?
It's not my area of expertise. I was involved in the meeting where we sent the team out. So we all met up with one of the senior officers, and we talked about the company and its struggles and the basics of the structure that we would try to work on. And then we sent a team over that was going to evaluate the assets.
And what was your counter-exposure? I'm sorry, back to that Friday at the end of business.
What was my...
Your counterparty exposure to Lehman that Friday.
The counterparty exposure.
Is Citi a creditor in the bankruptcy? What's the amount?
Yeah.
But we had a lot of exposure. We had loans at that point yet, and we've had lots of derivative exposure. It was probably 30,000 or 40,000 CDS trades alone. Mm-hmm. It's a major trading counterparty. So we've got exposure. We're taking daily mark-to-mark. So we're calling for collateral from them, or they're calling for collateral from us. So we close the weekend. And
we are definitely a creditor in the bankruptcy. We believe we have valid rights of set-off that should leave us with immaterial exposure.
So you're pretty much a secured creditor in the bankruptcy, you think?
We certainly believe so. Now it's kind of it's bankruptcy by litigation these days.
Yeah.
So we'll have to haircut that, right, to get out in some settlement with voracious creditors committee, whatever.
And that $2 billion is still with
yes.
the city. Okay. All right. Going back to the Lehman weekend, where were you? I'm just curious. Where were you? At the Fed at all?
On Saturday I was in the office. On Sunday I was at the Fed.
Mm-hmm. What were you doing at the Fed on Sunday?
There was a whole bunch of top banks and brokers mm-hmm. in the Fed. We were in one of their big cavernous halls, and each company seemed to take a little corner, a little section. And so in our section, we had a number of the seniors, and we were trying. We would be meeting in one of the big boardrooms, talking about what was going on and trying to work on different solutions and mm-hmm. just trying to stay abreast with what was happening, because I think everyone knew it was going to be a historic weekend, although I got to say, when I went there, I didn't realize how historic it would be.
Mm. Go ahead.
I don't know if you guys want to know about Saturday. I certainly can give you a very high level.
Of cities involved, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, so on Saturday... what occurred was the Fed, the SEC, et cetera, asked a number of banks to go in and value and to take mm-hmm. different parts of the company to look at. Citi, along with CSFB and Goldman, mm-hmm. were tasked with looking at the commercial real estate. And we produced these documents to the examiner and also to you, but essentially what we did is there were people from Lehman who were giving us data and essentially a spreadsheet with what Citi did is there were something like 2,300 line items for the commercial real estate, and there was no way. What the SEC and the Fed wanted was an answer about the mark on this by the next morning. So there were a lot of people mm-hmm. involved at Citi, but mostly commercial real estate folk. And what Citi chose to do was to focus on the 100 top line items, which essentially accounted for 80% of the value, and they tried to see how they would value those, obviously knowing that it was being done, really quick and dirty. On the others, what they did is kind of look at, this is this kind of loan of this vintage, where do we have, in general, where is Citi marking this stuff, and just put that down. They actually tried to do some valuation on the 100, a little more, slightly more sophisticated than what I've just described for the remaining 2,200. At the end of the day, Citi, Goldman, and CSFB came within a hair's breadth of each other in terms of the valuations. I believe the valuations ranged from something like 17 to 19 billion, or maybe it was 18 to 20 billion dollars. But that was a dramatically different number than Lehman had.
What did they have? Was it less than 50%?
I don't think it was less than 50%. My recollection is that number was in the mid to high 30s.
Okay.
So that was what Citi was doing on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
On Sunday when
and Pandit was there, of course, in the consortium.
Sure. Yep. Sure. I think all CEOs mm-hmm. were
summoned.
Were there. on Saturday, I think by 10 o'clock was there. Were you there for the announcement that the deal wasn't?
You said Saturday.
Sunday, were you there for
the
announcement?
Yeah, you were at the Fed.
That the deal was not going to happen?
Yes. So I
What time did you get into the Fed that day?
I got to the Fed pretty early. I think I was there by 8 o'clock, maybe even earlier. And
it was a 10 a.m. announcement that no deal with Barclays? Was that early?
It may have been. Right. It may have been.
They pulled us all into a room and they let us know that.
Right. But I mean, was it morning? Right? Was it early afternoon? Do you even recall that? I didn't know it was that early, actually.
I don't recall.
I
was struggling with the days. Now you want the minutes.
The one thing that I've heard. So when is Sunday football? When does that start? Because the story that I hear
1 p.m. out here, because it's 10 a.m. in California.
All these men in were just elated that they got to leave Citi's offices on the whole real estate thing and go home and watch football.
Mm-hmm.
So
That's interesting.
That's
we're going to have financial Armageddon. But
well, they had been up the whole night before. Yeah, I have no idea if it was an interesting game, but that's like a story that I hear, and it kind of stuck with me. So
I
assume you haven't heard.
Well, the UK's hours ahead.
You missed the football.
Yeah, I missed the football.
But what I do. Well, what I've heard, anyway, is apparently there was a 1:30 p.m. board meeting scheduled at Lehman where they assumed they would be approving a deal with Barclays. And they certainly knew by then and before then that they weren't going to be approving a deal with Barclays. And, in fact, they were pretty much being directed to file bankruptcy. So I certainly know the announcement came in before 1:30 p.m.
Yeah. So my best guess from the emails is somewhere between like 10 and noon.
And do you remember who made that announcement in the room you were in?
No, I don't.
Was it Geithner? Was it a top?
Yeah, it was one of those
top
guys.
Regulator. Okay.
We had everyone was there. So you had Paulson, Cox, Geithner. They were all in the room. Which one actually said it, I don't recall.
And do you recall, at that time, do you recall any discussion about now we need to figure something out other than bankruptcy?
Well, Lehman, no.
Yes. No.
No, the announcement was, today we will let a major broker-dealer fail. Mm.
At that time, did you think that the government should have stepped in? And
the time I was thinking is Merrill and Lehman, you know, I knew Merrill was struggling, and there was lots of discussions at that day what was going to happen with Merrill. So there were two brokers that were really struggling that day, and obviously Lehman was probably was the worst of the two, but two brokers were struggling.
Mm-hmm. And
no, there was never any discussion or never any thoughts by me personally or anybody I heard at Citi that the government was going to step in and stop this.
Were you surprised that the government did not step in? Or?
You're asking me personal questions.
Yes, I
was surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Because
you did
the magnitude
of
Lehman, I don't think anybody's too big to fail.
Okay.
But to go bankrupt instantly would cause a lot of chaos. At least that's what I would have thought.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have thought a workout over a 30, 60, 90-day period as opposed to an immediate bankruptcy. Because the immediate bankruptcy was already fragile and just pushed not just Lehman but a lot of companies into situations that maybe we could have foreseen some of the incremental stress that would come. And knowing the relationship that we have with Lehman, everyone had similar relationships. It wasn't just Citi who had major counterparty exposure to Lehman.
So I hear you saying you don't recall any discussion about the government stepping in. Once the announcement comes, whenever it comes, do you recall any discussion about another private sector solution? Because it's my understanding anyway that certainly by Sunday morning, the private sector consortium had agreed to finance the assets that Barclays was not willing to acquire as part of the acquisition. I guess my first question should be, is that your understanding too? Go ahead.
It would not be mine, so go ahead. I didn't know that.
I think that something happened on Saturday and something happened on Sunday, and they were both supposed to be private market solutions. The thing on Saturday was Barclays was only willing to buy assets X, the commercial real estate, and I think the private equity or the leverage loans, and so that's what the banks were supposed to come up. The banks were supposed to figure out what are the real marks on these.
Right.
And then if there's a deficit,
right,
they were supposed to finance it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was Saturday. But once the deal didn't happen on Sunday, then there was supposed to be a bank repo facility. So the industry was supposed to get together and create a very large $100 billion or so repo facility that any of the banks could draw on. So it was kind of a mutual support society.
And I was there for that.
Right, okay. The $100 billion, is that just the expanded PDCF that you're talking about?
Well, in the end, it didn't need to happen because of the expanded PDCF. What it was supposed to be was it was going to take any tri-party repo eligible stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Then at the moment, the window I don't think would take any equities. equity securities. So this was going to take
right,
all the stuff.
Expanded the collateral that was eligible
right.
for
and
BDCF
so
borrowings.
Once the Fed expanded what was eligible, then this was, I mean,
I hear
there was
saying.
An agreement to do it, but it was almost irrelevant.
Right. So given what you said, let me ask either of you, frankly. No, it's okay. I mean, I'm just trying to get
I know,
the facts.
You just because, want the information.
Yeah,
so
because what we have heard is that by Sunday morning, clearly I think before the Barclays announcement that or before the Paulson announcement that there's not going to be any Barclays deal, that the private sector consortium had done that, Mark, and had agreed to provide $40 to $50 billion
yes.
dollars of financing on those assets. And then the word comes down, Barclays is not going to do this deal because of the guarantee issue, blah, blah, blah. And at that point, since at least my understanding that you have this private sector consortium agreement on financing the bad assets, and Barclays' deal goes away for whatever reason, was do you recall any discussion at that point about we got to figure out some other kind of private sector solution?
No. I knew up to that point, and I don't know that there was another discussion that said we need to come with something different from the private sector.
Okay, and do you recall, hold on, and do you recall if there was any discussion, sort of what you talked about the government, you know, coming in to avoid a bankruptcy the next day and somehow finance a 30, 60, 90-day more orderly wind-down of the company?
In the meeting that I was in, the comments were, today we're going to let a broker deal fail, mm-hmm. then we're going to expand eligible collateral for the PDCF, and then the community is going to come up with this $100 billion financing.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, segue it differently, and Lehman survives. That's what I sequence it differently. Sequence it differently, and Lehman maybe makes it. That's what I remember thinking as the words were spoken. I thought, we could do this differently, and the company might make it.
Do you remember that Lehman was explicitly excluded from the expanded PDCF?
Yes.
Okay. And what was your understanding of why that was?
No one said the words, but I mm-hmm. assumed it was, you know, moral hazard related, that the government could not be behind every financial institution. Mm-hmm. So this is just me. We need to make an example that the government, you know, has certain limits of what it will and won't do. And mm-hmm. in this case, the government was saying, we're not going to step in, and we're going to see where the chips fall, and you know, that's what we did.
So understanding that you're thinking when you heard that the message that, you know, we're going to let a broker dealer fail and we're going to have the $100 billion repo for the expanded PDCF, and that your thought, at least, you know, if you sequence this differently, Lehman survives. Any discussions with any folk there at the time about if we sequence this differently?
While I may be inside city in my little world, I'm senior, I'm sitting in the back of the room. You know, it was a big boardroom, and all the seniors around the middle of the table, and there was discussions, but, you know, my voice was not heard.
Well, and that's fine, but were there discussions?
Not in the big room when I was there.
There wasn't an uproar that Lehman should be saved.
I don't care if there's an uproar or not, but it's as it was the obvious thought to you, and I can tell you it's been an obvious thought to a lot of people.
Yeah, I think anybody who was in the room probably thought the same thing, but no one said anything, at least in the room when I was there.
Everybody wanted to get back to the game.
No, because then we had to work. We then had to work on this $100 billion facility. So mm-hmm. we went from this big room with this big announcement to breaking into smaller groups to say, how are we going to structure this? And within a few hours, we had a term sheet, and you know, Pete, the senior risk officers from all the firms were signing up.
Mm-hmm. And then either of you. So you get this term sheet together for this $100 billion repo facility. Just take me through the sequence of events, how then, well, now we don't need it because we're going to expand the PDCF collateral eligibility.
We wanted both. The push was to have two things in place. One, mm-hmm. some sort of industry-sponsored solution. You know, let the industry step up and help each other. And there were some conditions that no one firm can borrow more than 33%. So the solution was supposed to be a multi-bank, multi-broker solution, and each one of us would step in to sort of help each other out in some financing.
Right, but my understanding, maybe I misunderstood you, is that while this $100 billion private sector repo program was going to be put in place to deal with suspected concern fallout from what's going to happen the next day. Ultimately, it's not necessary because the PDCF procurement expanded for right eligible collateral.
I don't think there's any usage on the facility.
Right, but this is, you guys come up with this term sheet for this $100 billion repo facility that's going to be provided by various investment banks, broker-dealers, banks, correct. Right? Yes. Ultimately, you don't need to do it because of the expanded PDCF program.
How there, do had you be get different, there had to be differences because when it was put forward, it's, the comment was, we're doing this, and then the private sector will come up with something slightly different. So I'm not sure exactly why what the differences were, but there was a thought that that other
so
solution was needed.
This, maybe there was, you know, maybe it reached some other thing.
Yeah, I don't think that what was going to be done in that facility could be done in the PDCF. So I think there was some tweaking, something that was different between the two, what eligible collateral would be in both.
Okay, so I understand there's differences. What I don't understand now is whether or not the private sector $100 billion repo facility was ever
I don't think it was ever used.
But was it put in place?
It was signed by many people, so there was an agreement to do this, but I don't think anyone ever called another to say, I want to do it.
So even though there's differences, is it fair to say, is it accurate to say that the expanded PDCF is what was used, the private sector repo facility was not?
I don't think the private sector repo facility was ever used.
Okay. And okay. And then what is your understanding of how, if you have one, of how the PDCF expanded facility comes to be? Do you just find out about that, or tell me?
Well, in the meeting, that was what was said. We are going to expand it. Exactly how, you know, I am not an expert on the PDCF, so I don't want to...
Okay. Is this the same meeting when they announced Lehman's bankruptcy?
Yeah,
or
it was three things.
Okay.
A broker will fail, we're expanding the PDCF, and this group of private sector banks and brokers will come up with a solution.
Now I understand. But when it was all said and done, the private sector wasn't necessary. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
And what was your thought process in terms of systemic risk? I know you've alluded to it before. Can you just lay it out again? That weekend, what were you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking, what a nightmare I'm going to have tomorrow. You know, these are major relationships, mm-hmm. and you know, we touch Lehman in so many different spots, and now we're going to go through, you know, one of the biggest workouts in my career for certain. So I'm thinking about the magnitude of that undertaking, and then you have, then I'm thinking of, well, we think we're in pretty good shape because we have this deposit. What is the impact on others who may not be in as good a shape? You know, what will happen to every other major counterparty? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what steps they have taken to protect themselves, if they've taken as much as we did or more or less. I don't know. So I'm thinking about how bad, what the domino effect of one will be. So one, Lehman going, what's the next step? But before the end of the day, we hear that Merrill and B of A have come to an agreement. So that takes one thing off my mind, and I don't have to worry all that much about Merrill. Mm-hmm. But then I'm still worried about Morgan, and I'm still worried about, you know, other firms that were having their own problems, you know, prior, maybe not as severe, but prior to Lehman.
Now, at the Fed that weekend, were there discussions about AIG?
None that I was involved in.
My last question is, why do you think Lehman failed?
You know, we probably talked about it a little bit as we went through the discussion. I think... You know, financial institutions, it's in some of my emails. Yeah, we always say financial institutions die of a heart attack. Corporates die of cancer. So a corporate, you tend to get more notice, and financial institutions can be rather sudden. So that's one of the things that we frequently will say inside our firm. Yeah, and loss of confidence is probably the biggest factor. You know, you can look at, you know, asset quality and all sorts of measures, but no company is liquid enough to sustain a massive run. Because right? If you're without liquid, then you're probably making, you don't have any profitability, any type of reasonable return. So you have a company that, you know, reportedly had $45 billion in liquidity, you know, but they were being, you know, attacked on every different side. You know, they were probably losing their prime brokerage, and they were getting everything that could go wrong was hitting them, and they were scrambling. And I think, ideally, we would have given them more time to work out, because I think then that would have been a much more, the markets wouldn't have gone into a chaos the very next day, and things that were tough to price were impossible to price, and closing out a trade was near impossible.
That's the other theory. CNBC killed Lehman.
Essentially,
when you need a 24-hour news cycle, mm-hmm. then there'll be a feeding frenzy in the media about whatever is the bad news.
Right. Yeah, listen, I have CNBC on all day long. You know, so I go to work every morning, and I have two screens, and the top right-hand corner is CNBC, and that's sort of my insight into live activity. Yeah, and then we price CDS, we get yesterday's pricing, and we're looking at other things to sort of gauge what's going on. But so you follow that stuff.
The contractual changes to last week of Lehman, that was completely private, right? That was not disclosed.
Completely private.
Okay. That would not cause a loss of confidence.
No. I think what's happening is you're seeing the stock price come down 10%, 30%, 40%, and it just everyone starts panicking about how bad will it get. Mm-hmm. You know, and so even though you may not have their equity and you have a derivative transaction or repo transaction, you're still thinking this could go bankrupt. And what should I do? And the steps that you do then makes it worse. So if you get someone who has a repo on and they want, from a 2% haircut, now they want 5, more stress on the company. And when you have so many related, they're a big repo book. That'll have a lot of stress coming from there. And then you have counterparties saying, maybe I was doing derivatives before without security. I want security. And maybe I don't want, just covering my mark-to-market. I want one and a half times my mark-to-market. So the terms of which people would deal with you change.
Let me ask you my last question for both of you. Is what kind of fallout have you seen from the bankruptcy, both city-specific and otherwise?
Wow. Big question. We've changed some of the things that we do as a result for it. We mentioned CLS. We no longer take clients of that scale into CLS. For us to manage a company's as a third party CLS member, it's probably the systemic risk is too great. So we have migrated out, Nomura, for instance, it's another big broker, and no longer a third-party CLS member. We've tightened the terms or our risk acceptance criteria of clients eligible for third-party CLS inside Citi. Now, we've worked out we've got written closeout procedures. Heretofore, we have always sort of knew in our heads what we would do when clients go bad, but we didn't have in writing what our closeout process would be. And I think we did generally a good job. Now it's written down so that the people who come after us won't have to learn the same lessons. So we've tightened those things up. We've developed systems which give us greater access into clients' real-time usage of intraday lines, which we didn't have a platform like that before. So we've taken steps to tighten sort of all the areas where we thought, wish we would have had better transparency into the usage. We've got a system that now does that. We had too much risk in CLS. We won't permit that to happen again. So I think, and so what's happening, Nomura now goes directly to CLS on their own. Now they've got to fund their own activity as opposed to relying on us.
So let me follow up. I mean, in terms of when I say city specific, I take it that any creditor, bankruptcy creditor type transactions you had with Lehman would have been easier, less costly, less time consuming to resolve had Lehman not gone into bankruptcy. Can you give us some kind of color
on
what it's been? I mean, and I'll tell you, one of the things we're trying to look at, in the too big to fail, rubric is one of the ways we're trying to determine whether Lehman may have been too big to fail is what have been the repercussions, on the various counterparties, on the markets in general. So to the extent you can provide us some color on what it's meant for Citi, that would be helpful.
Let me do that.
Either one of you can do it. And the guys at the end of the table, too.
Well, I think I'll go back to something I said earlier. Nobody is too big to fail. The suddenness of a failure, though, creates incredible stress. Mm-hmm. Right? So in this situation, we took a fragile environment. We all know what's going on with home price appreciation. So the environment was bad, and everyone knew we had Countrywide. We had so many things happen in front of Lehman that the situation was pretty, you know, fragile. And then pushing Lehman into an immediate bankruptcy caused what was whatever stability was left there just fell out.
So I guess one of the issues is if you've got a if you have a downward slope, how do you quantify for you the cost of making that steeper, right? Or not having a recovery sooner? And I think that's very difficult. I mean, obviously,
I think it's impossible.
Yeah, it is.
When you know, if you have a major broker dealer fail, it's a counterparty to a gazillion derivatives.
Right.
And people have, I mean, particularly at that time, CDS, or, you know, you have a matched book or you're hedged, right? So your hedge disappears. So everybody's hedge disappears from Lehman. There had been some thought, I think, if this is at all helpful, there had been some thought at the Fed, and they had opened a special trading day. I mean, they did know
right.
that there was going to be an awful lot, but it didn't work. I mean, some people may have found each other as offsetting trades, but at least from Citi's perspective, it wasn't. It didn't actually work. And then, given the panic in the markets, there was very little liquidity on, I mean, there was very little happening on the 15th when everyone's in shock. And then on the 16th, bid offer spreads for any kind of entering, you know, of then hedging your positions is incredibly high. You know, I don't know how you quantify.
Right. Well, we've heard about this derivative unwinding session on Sunday the 14th, and we've seen in, I think, the bankruptcy filings that, you know, immediately pre-bankruptcy, Lehman had about 930,000 derivative contracts. But then quickly, 700,000 plus are resolved, and they're down to like 200,000. If I'm doing my math right, if 200,000 derivative contracts that need to be resolved, you know, like the 16th, 17th of September. But I heard you said that this unwinding on Sunday didn't do Citi any good.
And this is complete surmise, that there are some entities that did plain vanilla swaps, you know, maybe fixed for floating or currency swaps, and they could find each other. And they could find each other and then settle off. Because if Lehman had a matched book, then there had to be
right.
people out there that could then find each other. And so maybe that happened, and Citi was just not much in that business
okay.
with Lehman and had much more either complex or...
Was Citi participating in the Sunday, September 14th, looking for the other
we
side
the,
of the,
we were in the room.
Match book?
Yeah.
You
know?
We were in the room. What we did, I don't recall that we did much, if we did any at all, but we had people in the room.
Okay, and understanding that it didn't do much for Citi, is it your understanding that there was a lot that was able to be done on that Sunday?
At least through the derivatives folk
right.
that I speak to, I had heard that... That some of the very simple FX or rates derivatives could, you know, got hard out.
So your interest rate derivatives, your foreign exchange derivatives, probably not a big problem. Your credit derivatives, a different story, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Jenny?
Yeah, a couple quick things. Prior to the private consortium, the weekend that Lehman declared bankruptcy, did you ever get... your city approach or have any conversations with any federal regulators regarding where they suggested that Lehman, that city should continue to clear?
Yes.
Can you tell me quickly about that?
I have a 12 o'clock meeting across town, so I have to go. So please finish, Mr.
Fontana.
Thank you for your time. Give me a ring.
Yeah.
Give me a ring when you have
on the other issue. Yes. I'm sorry. You said prior.
Yeah,
prior to.
But I don't want to use that meaning. But yeah, prior to.
No.
Okay.
Over
the
that weekend.
They have reached out to J.P. Morgan and some of the tri-party banks and suggested that they should continue to deliver and unwind. Any conversations like that happening?
Over the weekend.
Prior to that.
I'm not aware of that either.
Okay, but that during that weekend, you made it clear that you should continue to clear until we see the results. Is that fair?
For LBI, because it wasn't fun.
Until they filed. Okay. I may call and ask a follow-up question, if you'd be so kind. But one very quick question, just because I have a hole in my thoughts. In February of 2008, when actually it happened later, but the option rate securities freeze and all that, later on, Citi entered various agreements to purchase back up to $20 billion in option rate securities at par. Don't know whether the best efforts ever happened or not, or how much Citi ended up repurchasing. What I'd really like to know, and you can get back to me on this, two things. One, did that impact Citi and their liquidity situation, that the commitments that they had made? And two, how much has Citi ultimately purchased back? I'd love to answer some of those questions.
I'm sure we can find them for you. I don't think.
I don't have the answer. I'm sure it impacted us because it would take liquidity to do so.
You look at liquidity and risk, so you probably have a view that it did have an impact.
Yes.
But if you could get back to me with real answers on that, that would be accurate.
Do you have a card?
I don't right now. I can get you her.
Okay.
But that would be awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, I think Tom has questions.
One last question. And I can't resist this. And I want to understand the people dimension.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you mentioned a financial institution dies of a heart attack. You had seen a couple of those, Bear and Lehman. And I'm curious, you get back to the office, what are people saying? What does your relationship manager say when all of a sudden the person at the other end of that relationship is gone? What is the mood? I'm trying to figure out if it's anxiety, what's next?
I'll be very honest. We're all sad, right? Because these are people we've worked with for many years. I was RRM. Michael Marrowstein was RRM from the time that I moved on. So Michael was RRM for 7 or 8 years. You see them. You talk to them. You see that. We would have liked them to still be in business, right? So it's an emotional part, and then you got to get back to work and everyone else has fallen apart and you got to do what you have. So from that next day, we open a war room, and I'm sitting now opposite from, I've got my workout guy sitting next to me. I got the guy who has had my current role, the guy who was doing the managing the clearance sitting opposite me. And, we've trying to make sure we're classifying, we're watching Morgan taking collateral. So you go into a complete, environment which is just crazy. You're working 14, 15 hours a day. While I was getting to work at 6 in the morning and staying until 10 at night, going home, sleeping, come back. So that next week is what's all your risk? What do you have for Lehman? Hand it off to the workout guys so that they can make sure that whatever steps, because then I have to worry about the other clients. Mm-hmm. So my role is not to do the workouts. My role is to bring them up to speed, hand it off, and then focus on Morgan and Dexter and Nomura and all the other names, which hopefully we'll be able to get in a situation where if they go bad, we won't lose. It's a very difficult time. But the first thing is you feel bad for the people impacted. And we felt that way when bad went bad. Again, we know all those people for many years. Mm-hmm. And to see their net worth go down like it did, it's crushing. Now Lehman goes to zero.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see in the documents there's a lot of sadness, and there's also a sense that the market isn't being fair, and that the market is hair trigger and overreacting, and I saw emails between you and Fusket that were saying things like
September 12th, right?
Or like, how is it you're honest to the market and then you get beat up? Like they want us to be honest, but So there are, I think that there was just also some fear of the extent of overreaction that can be out there, is what
absolutely.
I think in addition.
And what role do hedge funds play? I mean, it makes sure you can't help but notice the novations and the types of clients that were novating, and then you listen to some of the analyst comments on CNBC and, it's an interesting environment that we're in the way we communicate today. So there's so much more communication, and you know, we can quickly develop a feeding frenzy, which is not healthy. Short sellers, and you have all those things putting pressure. I know at some point we sort of stopped the short selling. You know, I always thought that we should have kept that longer. You know, when we let that back in, then Citi went bad. Right, because now it was like, you know, people make money when stocks go down, you know, and if we really beat on Citi enough, well, then Citi stock, then we can make a lot of money. In a volatile times that we were in, it probably would have made sense not to permit that activity. And though we want to have open markets, but it was in a situation, it wasn't one counterparty. You know, if you go back to LTCM, one counterparty, we can get through it. This was the whole industry, or industries, struggling, and I think we needed to do something to stabilize it, and I think it wouldn't have been as bad as it was.
I'll give one more question, please. And you touched on liquidity problems, that in the end, that's where the hammer drops, and that unlike a bank run, all of a sudden it comes at you from many different directions. What lessons have you learned about liquidity risk management in a world of overnight, you know, huge amounts of overnight money, repos, derivatives? What have you learned that people need to do for effective liquidity risk management?
No, it's a great question, and I think that's what we've been spending the last 2 years. You know, how can we improve our insight, our transparency that we have into our clients? And a lot of it is more regular discussions, you know, meeting with clients, what monies are flowing through us, where is this money coming from, where does it go, is there ways that we can step out and we can have monies go directly and get Citi out of the middle? So we've had many conversations with clients about, you know, what is your normal route? How do you move money? And you know, why is this coming to us? Couldn't it go? So we've had, you know, we've actually given away business to reduce the risk and make the system be more efficient. Because we, you know, we tend to, we're always sort of a middle person. Mm-hmm. The clients want to move money from their accounts with us and go someplace else. And there are ways, and sometimes clients move monies from Citi from just to move from one entity to another entity of their own. Mm-hmm. So we've worked with clients about, you know, how they can do that on their end as opposed to coming through us. And then just, you know, education. We've the closeout process, we now do mock closeouts, which we had never done. You know, so now, you know, at least two or three times a year, we go through a mock closeout. So we will develop XYZ bank or broker, and we'll say, you know, and we actually play the game. I'm the risk manager. I play my regular role, and then somebody's going to be the CEO, someone else is going to be the CFO, and we put out an email. And we all know that this is going, so we know it's mock, and we make sure the emails are clear so no one inadvertently thinks it's real. And we say, this announcement just came out. And then we say, okay, what do we do? And then people say, we typically a 3 or 4 day event, and as the 3 or 4 days go, another announcement comes out, it's a little bit worse. And what are the, and see how people work, and it's very time consuming, but it keeps us ready, and I think it enables us then to think about things differently, more proactively, more forward looking, you know, in just our day to day.
I'm on the research side of this organization, and I've got to ask the question very generally. Is there a useful high level document on lessons learned about managing liquidity risk that we might look at? I will tell you why. I'm currently working on a piece on governance and risk management. And I didn't ask you because it didn't sound like that was your job, interactions with the board and how information filters up and down. But I'm really curious, trying to understand what people have learned about this, both on the side that you're not at, the treasury side, how do we match assets and liabilities more effectively, in terms of maturity, whatever. I'd be very interested if there are some internal documents that sort of take a high-level view of liquidity management.
Why don't we take a look? I mean, I'm not aware of anything that has been, you know, produced. Most of the document requests that we've had have, you know, kind of terminated as of they
sure.
didn't permit the backward glance,
right?
Because they're really of September 26th is the cutoff date for the searches.
Right, their interests are really quite
it's
different.
Very much about who did what to whom. So we'll take that back.
I would greatly appreciate that.
Okay.
And one very last question. The week coming into the Lehman bankruptcy, did you know that J.P. Morgan was making collateral demands and
no.
amending their agreements to cover their exposures?
No, we didn't.
Okay.
No, I didn't. Okay. I don't think we did, knew at that time.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Fontana. Thanks for your time.
My
very helpful.
Okay.
My pleasure.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You so much.
My pleasure.